This is Global Voices Radio.
Here's Paul Nelson.
Today, we conclude our two-part series with world-renowned storyteller Laura Sims. And while the stories she tells are a distraction in one respect, unlike the trash that passes for entertainment on TV, the stories she's talking about and telling are also an antidote.
I think that we live in a state of distraction from direct perception of reality or from the ability to feel without making stories up about it so that we fix on what we think we want as opposed to being alive in the world moment by moment.
Laura Sims is the author of The Robe of Love, Secret Instructions for the Heart. We continue now with our look at how stories are a key factor in helping us understand who we are and why we are here on this planet in this lifetime. The New York Times called Laura Sims a major force in the renaissance of storytelling in America. Laura Sims is the author of The Robe of Love, Secret Instructions for the Heart. The book contains 14 stories from places like Ireland, Korea, Morocco, and other exotic places around the world. Laura, pleasure to have you back on the program. Something I don't think we covered in our last interview was about the process. Could you tell us about the process you go about to get stories like the one we discussed in our last section in the book? Yeah, I mean, people don't say, hey, here's another one. Great, put this in. You know, it's a little more complicated than that.
It's the most complicated and mysterious question of all. Sometimes it happens just like that, where someone will send me a story. Sometimes I hear a fragment of a story, and then I read a story, and actually I don't really like it, but I can't stop thinking about a particular image. An image is the engine of story, and so I start to research. Many of the stories, oddly enough, that are in that book come from a phone call one day. This was about 15 years ago, where a librarian called me, and she said, there's a library that's closing. And they had a great collection, and they have booksellers who come and buy these books. They're a dollar each, and they sell them for hundreds of dollars. And I thought, I should call you, and you could come down here. And at the time, I had exactly $101 in the bank, so I took it out, and I bought 101 books. So there they were. And then one day, I was looking at this cover of a book, an old book, and it said Caucasian Tales, and I opened it up. It was printed in 1904, and I really loved the title of a few stories, and I read them, and they made no sense, and I'm very interested in making no sense. You asked before about preemptive war and such things, but a lot of times the stories don't really abide by our logic. They abide by a deeper logic, almost like a divine logic, or sort of something uncanny. And so I become obsessed with figuring out not what the obvious content of the story is, which I need to know, of course, to tell it, but I need to figure out, like, what the inside story is, like what the story that is going on in the chakras of the body, or what is the quest or journey, not even that is in the text, but like what's the journey that's going to happen in the body of the listener or in the space between us, the glowing space between us. So that's kind of, you know, how the whole process, it's a very complicated process. And sometimes I hear a story and I can tell it immediately, and then there are stories that will have to marinate for 15 or 20 years, or ones I tell, and then suddenly I realize, oh, that's not what it's about, and I tell it with a completely other point of view. And then it just I'm not tired of any of these stories. Particularly, you know, I've fallen in love with all the stories that are in The Robe of Love, and each of them has stories within stories that I don't even tell that have inspired me or infected me in some way.
Infected. Let's talk about one of those stories, The Garden Woman. It's a short tale.
I love that story.
Okay. You know, I think we have time for you to read it if you'd like to. It's up to you.
Read it.
Sure, here.
Sure.
Take my copy.
I'm a terrible reader being a storyteller, but I will read it because that will be fun. This is a Georgian tale as I know it, and it's really a story that I heard told by a great storyteller in France named Muriel Bloch, who I met because her mother heard me telling stories in Harlem and said we'd be friends, and that is true. And sometimes you have to listen to a mother. A wealthy young man owned a beautiful house with a well-tended garden. He did not like to work, so he hired a gardener to keep the rows of flowers and vegetables neat. This is the beginning of the story. Every evening at the same time before the sun set, the young man went to sit on a marble bench and admire his plants. One evening, he saw a crumpled piece of paper lying among his lovely flowers. He ordered the gardener to remove the mess, and he returned to his house. The gardener lifted up a dried onion and began to open the skin. In the middle was a piece of paper with words delicately printed on it. The gardener could not read, so he threw away the paper with the dried onion. And in fact, it's the reason why I don't in the book say what was on there, because I have no idea. The next morning, when the gardener came to work, he saw a woman walking back and forth between the rows of vegetables and flowers. She was dressed in leaves and petals adorned with stalks and dangling roots. She was beautiful, and the gardener was delighted. That evening, when the young man returned to his bench, he too saw the garden woman. Her beauty enchanted him. For the first time in his life, the idea of getting married entered his mind. He leaped over the rows of flowers and plants, calling out, "Who are you? What's your name?" The garden woman stopped walking, stood arms akimbo, and answered, "My name is Leek. I'm wearing a fennel belt, and I'm a garden woman." The young man was horrified. "I could never marry a woman named Leek," and abruptly turned and left the garden. Within weeks, who can understand men, he met a woman and married. He brought his bride home and did not return to view his garden for several days. The garden woman was distressed. Who can explain the female heart, which I see you have underlined, which goes to say, no one can, thank goodness. She called to the gardener, who adored her, and asked, "Could you milk 12 doe? Warm the milk in a bathtub placed in the middle of the garden. I feel a need to bathe." The gardener, who would have done anything for her, agreed. The next day, he climbed up the mountain into the forest and milked 12 doe. He placed the heated milk into a bathtub placed in the middle of the garden for her to bathe. That evening, our young man came again to admire his garden. As he sat down, the garden woman removed her clothing of leaves and petals and stepped naked into the heated milk. The young man had never seen anything so remarkable. He rushed home to his bride and told her about the beautiful naked woman in the garden taking a bath in hot milk. She remarked, "That's interesting." The next morning, the wife ordered the gardener to move the bathtub to the front of the house and fill it with the boiled milk of 12 cows. The gardener was hired to obey his master's whim, so he agreed. That evening, as the new husband set off for his garden, his bride called out, "Oh, come, look." She took off her clothes, stepped into the boiling milk, and unfortunately, she boiled to death. What a pity. Days later, the widower remembered his garden. He went to his marble bench at the usual hour, and there, walking up and down the aisles of flowers, was the garden woman again. He had a desire to get married. He jumped over the rows of plants and lettuce and called out, "Please, what's your name? You must be called Carnation, Dahlia, Tulip, Lily, Rose." Hands on her hips, the garden woman stood still and answered, "I told you. My name is Leek. I'm wearing a belt made of fennel. I'm a garden woman." The young man was offended. He said, "I could never marry a woman named Leek." He went home. Within days, he was married again. The garden woman missed him. She asked the gardener to find her a wooden loom, a wooden shuttle, and a little silver knife. The gardener was happy to do whatever she asked without question. "Please place the loom, the shuttle, and the knife on the roof of his house. This evening I feel like singing and weaving." When it was dark, the garden woman climbed up a ladder to the roof and began to weave and sing. The young man saw her from the window. He woke his bride, said, "There's something remarkable occurring on our roof." She looked at the beautiful woman dressed in leaves weaving on the wooden loom and said, "That's interesting." At that moment, the garden woman pretended that the shuttle fell from her hands. "Oh, I dropped the shuttle. She took out the silver knife, cut off her nose, and sent it. Please bring me back the shuttle. The nose soared down, lifted up the shuttle, and brought it back to the garden woman. She put the nose back on her face and continued weaving. The young man remarked, "That was astonishing." The new wife said nothing. But the next day ordered the gardener to keep the loom on the roof. Scratching his head, the gardener thought, "What is it with these women?" That night, the new wife sat on the roof weaving and singing. The young man was pleased. When he stretched his head out to get a better look, she feigned, "Oh," dropping the shuttle. Then she took the silver knife, cut off her nose, and sent it after the shuttle. Unfortunately, she bled to death. Several evenings later, the young man returned to his marble bench to look at his garden. The garden woman was walking back and forth among the growing things. Again, he was smitten with an uncanny desire to get married. "Who are you?" he said, leaping over the flowers. "What is your name? You must be called Narcissus, Iris, Gardenia, Orchid." She said, "Look, I have told you already twice. My name is Leek. I'm wearing a belt of fennel, and I'm a garden woman." This time, the young man heard her words and raced up the side of the mountain. He threw off his clothes and bled the neck of a wild pig and covered himself in blood. Then he rolled his body in the mud, ran down to the garden again. The young man lay down on the earth between the flowers and vegetables by her feet and said, "Please, tell me who you are." She answered, "You know who I am. My name is Leek. I'm wearing a belt made of fennel. I'm a garden woman. Get up, go home, wash yourself, get dressed, and let's get married." And that's what they did.
And the moral of the story is never give your copy of a book to your guests because they'll steal your thunder.
What do you mean by that?
Well, it's funny. You notice that's my process of doing interviews is to read the books and to underline the salient points. And you had it right there. And you know, there's something about that story and other stories that there is a line in there. And maybe I'm just reflecting my personal mythology. Who knows? And I'm happy to do that. But who can explain the female heart? Is the line in there.
Everybody asks me about that story. Saturday night, I was in a theater in Indiana. There, because the woman who runs that theater had heard the story, and I think she just wanted to have the chance to drive me to the theater and ask me, "What does that story mean?" So I said, "Well, let's just think about it together." And there's something so compelling and funny. I mean, I love telling it, and I love being that woman. But I did do a lot of research and looked up the Leek, which was an ancient Egyptian symbol for the goddess, and thought a lot about authenticity and really seeing things for what they are. And also, just, she's of the earth. She's completely of the earth, the magic of it. The trick for all these stories is, if I can give it away, is that none of the stories, even the stories that we retell about our own life, are true in the telling. What's true is what happens in the mind of the listener. And it's almost as if in this story we have some waking dream and this internal marriage of this guy who finally somehow gets it. And the images are quite compelling. They're unrelenting in this story. I mean, naked, covered with pig's blood, lying in the mud saying, "Who are you?"
Yeah, cutting off your nose and bleeding to death. I mean, you know, it's interesting how...
that part.
that's one part. There's a couple of deaths in there, as I recall. But, you know, there was a movement, I don't know, about 10 years ago to start taking the violence out of all these old fairy tales. And those are the parts that the kids crave. They want to hear about this. It's not the same kind of violence that we see in maybe, a Schwarzenegger movie, Terminator or something like that. It has a whole different sort of effect, doesn't it?
Right. Well, if we don't actually within ourselves confront all the possibilities of who we are, we end up doing exactly what we're doing in the world today, which is enacting far more brutal violence and unconscious dissociation from compassion than any of these stories ever imagined.
Yeah. Well, you say that reading a story is refreshing because it distracts us from the stories that haunt our everyday lives, which keep us from remembering what you say is the constant presence of love. like those Hollywood movies, like the news on TV, whether it's O.J. Simpson or whatever latest celebrities in trouble, distractions. And yet, what you're saying is these stories are a distraction, but a distraction towards maybe something more real.
They're a distraction so we can engage in being alive and present. And also, we're trying to make logic of something which is, I think, more intelligent beyond logic. I think that we live in a state of distraction from direct perception of reality or from the ability to feel without making stories up about it, so that we fix on what we think we want as opposed to being alive in the world moment by moment. I'm very much, impressed, informed, and quite devoted to the practice of Tibetan Buddhist meditation, in which my teachers have really instructed me like this, and I feel it's been a great learning to be a storyteller, besides being Jewish, born in Brooklyn, living in New York, and the rest of it.
And we'll follow up on that in just a moment, talking with Laura Sims, storyteller, author of The Robe of Love, Secret Instructions for the Heart, by Paul Nelson, of Romanian heritage. And you had a chance to go back to your ancestral homeland and work with orphans. Can you tell us about how you're using story to help people devastated by the circumstances of life to find hope and meaning in their life again?
Well, I do a series of projects in Romania, and one is working with teenagers who have grown up in what is euphemistically called orphanage or institution. They're quite sort of caringless places. And so I tell these young people a lot of stories and also have them then become storytellers for young children in the institutions. This is kind of an experiment to see if filling them with different images than they are accustomed to, whether they can find the inner capacity to imagine a better future. And also by taking care of other, you always find meaning in life because you have value. And so they make a kind of family situation with these younger children. They become the mentors for them. And out of that grew a project which I really love, came to me through really accidental circumstances. And I work with Roma or Gypsy women, very, very poor Gypsy women. Same thing. I thought in the beginning I was telling them stories to connect them to their heritage, which they have, like many traditional peoples in the world, and maybe all of us, forgotten. But more it has to do with a kind of empowerment. They cheer up. While listening to the stories, they cheer up. They remember things about their own ability to imagine beyond the very desperate situation they live in. And so some of them do tell stories to their children, or a couple of them are training to become storytellers. But it's more about how you learn to communicate, how you learn to feel some love for yourself when you live in a situation where you've been trained to hate yourself and the rest of the culture hates you, basically. So that's been extraordinarily, I learned a lot from it, and extraordinarily interesting. And then I do work with a lot of war victims, ex-child soldiers, and amputee victims from Sierra Leone through a series of projects. In fact, I've adopted one child from Sierra Leone who's now graduating from Oberlin College as an A student, who was in a war, and he remembered the stories that he grew up with. It really was a great healing for him.
The closest many Americans have come to war is watching the events of September 11th, or if you're from New York, actually being in that city when it came under the attack of the terrorists. Can you talk to us about your response to September 11th? And in that response, I'm thinking about addressing how right after that, this country had the sympathy of the world. Within a year, that sympathy was totally squandered in a war that was not supported by and large by the rest of the world. Can you talk to us about September 11th and how you were affected by it, and how story has become, well, obviously part of your way of helping to reconcile what happened on that date?
I was home. I live downtown. So I live on the east side. And so I didn't see the buildings fall except on television, but I did watch thousands and thousands of people walking down the street, covered with dust in a kind of uncanny silence. And I went to actually offer my services to tell stories, but it was too soon in the trauma of it. So I spent that month really talking to storytellers all over the world, and I put together a book called Nourishing the Hearts of Our Children in a Time of Crisis. And that book, which is still, now it's in its fourth printing, and I tried to choose stories that were about really confronting the truth of death and also really discovering one's own goodness regardless of circumstance or what inspires resilience. So it did have a great effect on my life because I realized how incredibly nourishing it is to have a story that's so much richer than an explanation, so much more dynamic, that allows you to really feel the fullness of the tragedy, but consider it in a bigger way rather than being only captured in what happened that day. And I feel that the compassion that I felt in New York was almost like a time of grace. It was uncanny. This doesn't take away the tragedy of what happened to people, but there was also this almost like gift of, it was like being in a tribal situation, or like when I was in the rainforest of the Philippines with the Chiboli people, it had that feeling about it every day. And what happened was that rather than allowing story to heal us and that compassion to allow us to deal in the uncanny mystery of what happened, we were receiving moment by moment a kind of, not really a story, but a tale, a manipulative tale that kept taking us away from the food that being, that tender heart can actually give us as human beings. Suddenly, I saw that it wasn't far away from us, that it was so easy to become your neighbor or your enemy's best friend. It was our nature. It was normal. But then suddenly that was closed down and fear was brought back in, rather than knowing fear to develop the fearlessness of kindness.
Do you think that's what's one of the best things about Americans, our response to tragedy? You talk about barn building as one Amish barn building, but when the flood's happening with the sandbagging, that kind of thing, you see pictures of Americans after a tragedy responding like that. Do you think that's at the core of what is truly special and unique about Americans?
I think that's especially unique about human beings, that at the core of who we are is sharing, and that's the real motivation of community and life. We have had tremendous opportunity to dream of futures, and working in an ex-communist country where people have this kind of behavioral dysfunction and a tremendous amount of despair, I can see that I grew up with the ability to, even though I would say our sort of Prussian education system is not like, it's kind of strange, I grew up with the capacity to dream, the capacity to imagine that I could change my life, that I could be, a kind of lower middle class girl in a certain neighborhood in Brooklyn, and that I could get a PhD if I wanted, or even that I could do something as unusual as what I have done, becoming a storyteller. But that kind of very rich thinking is what seems to me is being pulled back now. There's a kind of fear of the imagination, a fear of that of freedom. And I think that we have also this unique opportunity in America of having so much comfort that we've mistaken that comfort for freedom, and we're protecting comfort rather than protecting freedom, which is something that is a unique experiment we've had here.
We're out of time. Thanks for being on the program. Continued success with your work. It was a true pleasure and honor to have you on the show.
Thank you very, very much.
Laura Sims has been our guest. You can find more information about her at her website, laurasims.com. You'll find a link on our website. She is the author of The Robe of Love, Secret Instructions for the Heart.